Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. When people are taking all kinds of courses online, from YouTube to Coursera to Masterclass, why can't America's colleges and universities do much the same? Perhaps the COVID-19 rush to online wasn't perfect, but it proved that it could be done. As high-speed internet access makes it possible to deliver high-quality courses to remote places, some universities have developed interesting hybrid models. We'll discuss the possibilities for the abundant university. That's all today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Michael Smith, and he is a professor of information technology and marketing at Carnegie Mellon, their university's Heinz College of Public Policy and Management. And he's written a new book called The Abundant University, Remaking Higher Education for a Digital World. And a lot about your book is really fascinating to me. Many of us think that we know what it's like to get courses from afar, what that abundant university might look like. And yet, Michael, I know there are many skeptics who might say that the in-house instruction, the limitation, the scarcity issue that you raise time and again in your book is what makes college, college, if you will, being on the campus, the social life, all the other activities. And yet, you say there is so much about the new digital world that gives us greater possibility of opening up a great learning experience to so many others.
This is one of the interesting things. I think whenever you see digitization come in and change something, there's a group of people who say, oh no, any change would be bad. And what I'm trying to argue, and that's natural, it's totally understandable. What I'm trying to argue in the book is this sort of abundance is bad except for the parts that are good. We've got to pay attention to both of them. The argument that it's all bad, which you commonly hear from people in higher education, I find really ironic, because if it's all bad, then we owe a big refund to the students who went through Zoom education, you know, during COVID. Find a lot of people who on one hand will say, no, the Zoom education we delivered during COVID was a complete disaster, but then who are at schools who are claiming that the Zoom education is as high a quality as what the students would have gotten in person, therefore we're not giving a discount. We can't have it both ways.
Well, I thought it was fascinating that you opened up talking about this thing that we've all seen advertised, and I actually took a course on it relating to screenwriting. We're talking about Masterclass. And the fact that you can get this whole bundle of these incredible experts for, I don't know, $200 a year, and you have access. And you talked about Joyce Carol Oates and being able to be in a classroom with this vaunted Princeton professor at a cost of $200 for her and everyone else for a year is pretty remarkable stuff.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to at least show my colleagues and show the readers of the book the potential here, right? But prior to Masterclass, if you wanted to take Joyce Carol Oates' class at Princeton, she admits 10 students a year. So first you got to get into Princeton, then you've got to pay the $60,000 to $80,000 tuition, and then you've got to show up at 7 a.m. in the morning to hopefully get one of those 10 slots, right? That's scarcity. The flip side is abundance, with Joyce Carol Oates teaching on Masterclass, for anyone who has $12 in internet access can get access to that class, right? Is it the same as what you get at Princeton? No, but it gives an incredible amount more access than what we've got today. If the best we can do is the on-campus experience, then we're kind of stuck, because we're always going to be in this world where only 10 people a semester can get access to Joyce Carol Oates. I think we can use technology to do better for the many people we're leaving out of today's system of higher education. That's what I'm trying to argue in the book.
And you do talk about the socioeconomic impact of this scarcity and the fact that great kids in rural communities where they didn't have access to, let's say, the best high school or whatever it might be, even though they might have been top of their class there, competing with other kids who went to school. I live in Connecticut. So say they went to school in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Sure.
You know, they're going to be at the top of the pile. And yet these kids really would benefit so much if even remotely they had access to education, because we do have this yawning income inequality, and it's all related to education, seemingly.
What we know from the data is, A, getting to, at least today, getting a four-year degree is a key driver of whether you're going to be wealthy in the future. But we also know that being wealthy is a key driver of whether you're going to get into a four-year, particularly an elite four-year school. And if you look at those two things side by side, you realize we are creating a terrible feedback loop, you know, where if you get into college, you're going to be wealthy, and being wealthy determines who gets into college. What does that feedback loop look like? What we know, and this is Raj Chetty's research at Harvard, he's an economist at Harvard. What we know is that if you're a kid born into a family in the top 1% of the income distribution, you've got a 1 in 4 chance of going to an elite college, where he defines elite as top 80 most selective school in the United States. 1 in 4. If you're a kid born into the bottom 20% of income, you've got a 1 in 300 chance of going to the same university. I'm trained as an economist, which means I believe in the efficient allocation of scarce resources. If we in higher education genuinely believe that rich kids just happen to be 77 times more likely to be capable of an elite education, then the system's working just the way it should. But if we don't believe that, and I don't know anyone who does, then this is a terrible way of allocating access to elite higher education. And we ought to be ashamed of ourselves, quite frankly.
And frankly, we're looking at almost $2 trillion in student loan debt that some people, again, those who get into a mid-level school, a state school, you know, good schools, but, you know, they may be paying that off into their 40s. That delays all kinds of other opportunities, including the formation of family. And that's the way that America really moves economically, is by buying those hard goods that create family and create opportunity going forward as adults. They're delaying all of that because of all this debt. If we could lower that, and this would do that substantially.
That's the real challenge we face as a society, is that $2 trillion in, you know, nearly $2 trillion in student loan debt isn't going away if we continue to rely on the existing system. Part of the point I'm trying to make in the book is, number one, our current system of higher education is morally unsustainable, and we talked about that. Number two, it's financially unsustainable. College tuition has increased at 4 times the rate of inflation over the last 50 years, and unless we do something, is likely to continue to do so over the next 50 years. I just don't see how that's sustainable. The third point I try to make in the book is these problems are systemic, which means we're not going to solve it by tweaking the existing system of higher education. And finally, that I think technology gives us a way to create a new system, not as a replacement, but as an alternative to the current system of higher education.
And there are so many reforms that need to take place in higher education, particularly as we're all seeing, though I think you pointed out, but I don't think a lot of people in the general public quite understand, this de-credentializing movement that is going on at this moment in time, where states like Pennsylvania, Utah, Maryland are saying if you're a mid-level state worker and you don't have a specific skill set that required a college education, we will take equivalent opportunities, whether you have a certificate in technology, whether you were working in the military and acquired various skills. So people have to realize, I think in higher academia, things are changing and evolving. And you say that they haven't really woken up to that. They like the ivory tower that they've built and they want to stay in it, but the digitization and the decredentialization, if I can get both of those D's out, really are going to affect them in tremendous ways going forward.
This is the big challenge that I have in talking about this book. Is back in 2010, when MOOCs became popular, massive online open courses became popular, a whole bunch of people said the abundance of the education is going to disrupt higher education. If everybody can get access to the education, then higher education is going to be disrupted. And it hasn't happened in the way that many people predicted. What I'm trying to argue in the book is the reason it hasn't happened is because the education is only part of the power of colleges and universities. A big part of their power is the credential. You can take as many edX courses as you want, you can take as many online courses as you want, but it's not going to give you the same power in the job market today as a four-year degree. If that would change, that's when higher education gets disrupted. And to your point, I think we're starting to see that change. So I've got a slide in the deck I give on this book, and the first build of the slide is a whole bunch of headlines from outlets both on the right and the left saying employers and government agencies are de-emphasizing the college degree. Mm-hmm. And then the next build of the slide is a quote from each of those articles saying, and they're doing it because they want a more diverse workforce. And they've realized they can't get the diversity they want if they continue to rely on four-year degrees, right? If you want to hire a bunch of rich kids, go ahead and keep relying on four-year degrees. But yeah, if you want to hire a socioeconomically diverse group of people, you're not going to get it by relying on traditional higher education.
Well, with groups like Opportunity at Work and companies like Apple and Google and others really buying into this concept. And look, there are so many kids who've gotten certificates that say in user experience to guide you through an app online that now you don't really need a full college degree to really get a good paying job. The book is called The Abundant University, Remaking Higher Education for a Digital World. Michael Smith, might I ask, as you look at this, and you have really studied this issue, where are you getting the greatest pushback? Is it the elite colleges, or are they walled off saying, you look, somebody wants to go to Columbia, somebody wants to go to Cornell, somebody who wants to go to Princeton, they're going to go. And part of that is the whole legacy issue. And you might bring us into what the Supreme Court ruling of a recent vintage might do in that regard and some of the attempts to push back on legacy admissions. But start with the elite colleges. Are they the ones pushing back or do they not even care? Does this not even show up on their radar?
I was sort of hoping that I'd see more engagement from the elite colleges. And honestly, what I'm feeling is we're going to be just fine. And they probably are, to be quite honest with you. One of the things I try to make clear in the book, elite colleges are going to be just fine. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford, MIT, I hope Carnegie Mellon, we're all going to be just fine. What I really hoped, though, is even though we're going to be just fine, that there would be some more engagement on, but I have this mission to create more access to disadvantaged groups, and I want to pursue that, and I want to pursue that so much that I'm willing to change. That's not what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing generally is, I'm going to be just fine. Why should I change? And I was talking to one particular person at a particular university and talking about the book, and basically what he said is, you know what, Mike, I hear everything you're saying. I think you're 100% right, but I'm going to retire in 5 years. My job is to keep the business running for the next 5 years, and the best way to do that is by relying on what we've always done.
What about administrators? Because I know a lot of the costs associated with the universities today, at least that I've read, it comes with a lot of layers of administration. Can those be cut back, and would those be points of resistance when you start going to something that is more hybrid or more online? Does some of that get cut out of the layers of administration?
One of the really interesting things about being an administrator in higher education today is you're heavily reliant on the U.S. News and World Report rankings. You're heavily reliant on the rankings. And one of the big factors in the U.S. News and World Report rankings is what's called student resources. How do you measure student resources? You measure it based on how much do you spend per student. I think that gives universities a lot of incentives to try to increase their spending per students, either by building big fancy buildings or by hiring new employees. Once you get those employees in place, they want to protect their jobs. And so it's really hard to change the system from inside.
Well, give us some examples of schools that have adopted a kind of wait and see, but let's try it, let's experiment. I mean, I know when I see ads for Phoenix or South now, I see this new university, South, popping up. But there are many colleges that do have this combination of available courses online as well. I mean, they're on Coursera, they're on many other platforms. So is that just a dalliance, or are there some universities that you could point to who've really started to look at this new ad mixture and figure out a different model?
I'll give two examples. One is, I think what Mike Crow is doing at Arizona State University is incredibly innovative. What he's saying is, let's continue to give a residential, traditional residential in-person experience, and let's have an online experience under the same brand. And what he's discovering is, having an online experience allows him to give access to a whole bunch of people who otherwise would have been shut out of the residential experience. But B, I think they're learning a lot about how to create the optimal mix of in-person and online. And the example I talk about in the book is, I talked to Ara Austin, who's the professor who teaches Arizona State's online organic chemistry class. Right. And so you said, how the heck do you teach organic chemistry online? Right. How do you do the lab component? And what they discovered is, Ara and her colleagues looked at the curriculum, and what they discovered was, you know what? About 11 of the 12 weeks work perfectly well online. And for the labs, what they do is they bring the students on campus and they do a 1 week intensive lab experience where you do two labs a day for 6 days. In testing the students and in surveying the students, what they discover is that the students who get the intensive lab experience with everything else remote have equivalent knowledge of the material as the people who do the residential, the in-person organic chemistry class. But the students who do the online classes and the intensive in-person lab experience walk away with a much higher identity as scientists. So there's something about doing that organic chemistry lab, two labs a week for 6 days, that the students walk out going, oh no, now I'm a scientist, that they wouldn't get if they did the same labs, one lab a week over the course of a 12-week semester. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Right? So, it's, we can deliver equivalent knowledge and a better identity as scientists if we develop this mix the right way. I think what Arizona State is doing is incredibly cool. You're right. Southern New Hampshire University is also doing something very similar, where you've still got the Southern New Hampshire University residential experience, but they've got 135,000 students who'd get the online experience, and many of those students wouldn't have been able to come to the residential campus.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of these mid-level colleges, and as much as Connecticut has Yale, for example, we have a lot of mid-level colleges, I'll call them, Quinnipiac, Sacred Heart University, and I think they're going to be feeling a real pinch very soon because the demographics have been changing. We have fewer young people. If somebody has two children today, that's probably the limit for many. So the question is, what else is going to drive a movement away from where we are today with all of the cost structure built as it is? And scarcity, as you say, time and again, being the model, because that gives you the opportunity to raise the cost of it. It also, you know, gives your ranking a higher score if you reject more students. But when that becomes less of an incentive, then what do you do if you want to survive? And how much will the digital option become a part of that?
I think you're 100% right. I think we're going to see a lot of the mid-tier universities facing up to the fact that their business model doesn't work anymore. Part of it's the demographic cliff. I think part of it is going to be students looking for other options. I personally think that Arizona State and Southern New Hampshire kind of have the big broad online education market kind of sewn up. But I do think there are opportunities for some of the mid-tier places to serve niches. And one of the schools that I think is fascinating is Spelman University, right?
Mm-hmm.
Historically all women's, HBCU has moved into the online space and has been incredibly successful and is running a surplus with their online degree. So let's keep the traditional Spelman on campus degree, but let's also expand access to people who otherwise wouldn't have been able to get that Spelman degree. That to me is one example of a way to create a niche online educational experience that is sustainable.
Earlier in our conversation, you discussed the fact that during the pandemic, lots of schools were forced into this major attempt to do digital learning, and they had what they considered to be mixed results. But that was under a great deal of stress.
Yeah.
I was shocked at how high schools and, you know, even some elementary schools and colleges were able to adapt as quickly as they did. What did they learn from that experience? What went right? What went wrong? And how much are people applying that emergency effort toward a more sustained effort?
I think if folks were paying attention, right, if you want to defend the traditional model, then it's really easy to say, online education we delivered during COVID was a complete disaster, and I've heard that a lot. I think if you were looking, there were a lot of things about online education that I thought worked better than what I had in the classroom. One of them was guest lectures, right? You know, it's much easier to ask someone, you know, who's an expert on a particular topic to say, would you have 80 minutes next Tuesday to come and talk to my class versus, you know, would you be willing to fly out to Pittsburgh next Tuesday to talk to my class? And so during COVID, I was able to bring in, you know, bunches of really great guest lecturers. In fact, I had two lobbyists on opposite sides of a really, really important public policy question. They came to my class virtually and debated the two sides of the issue. I think the students walked away with a heck of a lot better understanding of the issue than if they would have had to rely on me, you know, trying to parrot these two arguments. The other story I heard, which I find absolutely fascinating, was, let's just say a top business school had an executive education program, and they felt like it needed to be done in person because you needed that unique in-person, you know, cohort experience, rubbing elbows, blah, blah, blah. And the only thing, this was told to me by a faculty member, the only thing wrong with the program was they weren't getting female executives to sign up in anywhere near the numbers they knew they existed in the marketplace. During COVID, they took that exec ed, you know, residential exec ed program online, and guess what? Female executives showed up in the right proportion. And what they realized is, you know, through a set of processes that my wife and daughter would describe as the patriarchy, you know, that female executives aren't able to take 7 weeks away from their family in the same way that male executives can. And so they're shut out of the process. Unless we adopt a different model, then we can include them. Guess what? The same business school, you know, was so excited about the increase in diversity that they've decided to leave that program online even after COVID.
Let me ask you about professors, because we have fewer full-time associate professors or tenured professors. What I hear at a lot of the mid-level schools is that everybody's an adjunct. And, you know, that doesn't always translate because they're making, believe me, I was an adjunct once, and I think I made $3,500 a semester for a whole lot of work for 15 kids. You know, if you could really expand that and really weed out those who are really capable professors, or you get the associate professor or the tenured track professor and not the adjunct, how much is that playing in? Because how long do people want to pay for an education where you've got a frazzled professor who's living out of their car and teaching at five different schools at the same time?
That's not good for anybody, right? It's not good for the professor. It's not good for the student. One of the other perversities of the process that, you know, so that's on the adjunct side. One of the perversities of the project on the tenure track side is we don't have any strong incentives to be good teachers either. One of the stories I tell in the book is when I was coming out and starting on the tenure track, basically, I was told by every senior professor, don't give any extra time to your teaching because being a good teacher won't get you tenure. The only thing that's going to get you tenure is being a good researcher. So spend as little time as possible on your teaching as you can. So I thought, well, teaching is irrelevant, but I still wanted to be a good teacher, and I was kind of proud of that. I was actually at a conference pretty early in my career where a senior faculty member at another school asked me, so how are things going? And I said, well, you know, I'm getting my research out. It's going well. And oh, by the way, I won the teaching award in our program last semester. And he said, huh, it kind of sounds like you're spending too much time on your teaching, doesn't it? Right. And what I realized is, you know, sort of not only is teaching quality irrelevant, it's actually a negative signal, right? You know, if you were a serious scholar, you would spend all of your time on your research and not pay attention. That's just bad. The other perversity that I think is interesting is to get tenure, I had to become the world's recognized expert, whatever the heck that means, in this incredibly narrow area of my field, right? So my value to the academy is I'm a specialist. And that's great, except when I get in the classroom, I'm asked to teach like a generalist. Right. So I'm the expert on this particular topic, but I'm going to teach 12 different topics where somebody else is the expert. Wouldn't it be cool if we could create a situation where I can teach my topic, Eric Brynjolfsson can teach his topic, you know, Natalia Labina can teach her topic, blah, blah, blah. We've never had the opportunity to do that. Now we have the technology where you could actually do that. Right. Let's get the world's recognized expert in this area to teach what they're best at. I think that could be pretty exciting.
And the technology on the receiving end is getting so much better. We have laws now in place through this administration to really expand broadband. So there really is less of an excuse. And you remind us in the book, and I think this is a really powerful point, aside from even the income disparities that represent the college experience for so many or for so few, depending upon where you fall on that you know, scale, that traditional higher education doesn't work for all types of students. Why don't you just delve into that for a moment?
My oldest son and my youngest daughter are both dyslexic. You know, they are never going to demonstrate their understanding of the material in a timed written test. That's just not the way their brains are wired. And yet the vast majority of our evaluation is based on how quickly can you, you know, read a passage and write a response. The other things we talk about in the book, are people who might have other disabilities, you know, Crohn's disease, where the traditional classroom model doesn't really work well for you. I think we can create a whole bunch of new opportunities for students who wouldn't necessarily thrive in the traditional classroom model, not because they're not smart, but because of they're different, to help them demonstrate their difference and in a way that honors that difference. One of the beautiful things about our society is all of these differences. One of what I think is the tragic part of higher education today is we have kind of a one-size-fits-all measure of intelligence. I'd love to create more opportunities for students who don't fit into the traditional bins to have opportunities to demonstrate their intelligence, their skills. And I don't think we can do that from within the existing system.
And how long can academia set itself apart? I mean, now if you look at publishing, and you point this out, if you look at the arts, you look at even distributing music today, it's not done by major record companies. It's done by individuals who learn things online. There's so much already rich content there that we go to. I mean, for small projects, we go there all the time. On YouTube, I'll find out how to fix this thing or do this thing. I taught myself piano online, thankfully. And so, you know, how long is it going to be before academia wakes up to this? And are the people who lead the universities today capable of this? Or is it the next generation of leadership coming up that will really grab a hold of a lot of the concepts in the abundant university and say, of course, this is the way we're going to go?
I think we've seen some really visionary, strong leaders like Paul LeBlanc, the president of Southern New Hampshire, like Mike Crow of Arizona State University, grasp onto this. I really hope that we'll get more traction on that. We'll see more people moving in that direction because they see the potential of this to create more access and opportunity. But the longer I talk about this, the more worried I get that our current system is benefiting so much from the status quo that we're willing to maintain that status quo, even though we know the status quo is incredibly harmful to anybody who's outside of the top 1% of the income distribution.
But I think there's going to be so many pressures that inevitably, you know, that which seems impossible ultimately becomes inevitable. And I think we're going to be getting to that point. I don't know when we cross to that line, but I think we're getting there. And I think your book will help people to see the possibilities in all of this. And again, I really encourage you to read this book, Michael Smith, The Abundant University, Remaking Higher Education for a Digital World. And at least my vision in 10 years is much more along the lines of what you say we should be doing. And again, maybe they're going to go kicking and screaming there, but I think they're going to get there, many of them. I really do.
So One other way to think about this is the entertainment industry. Like I teach disruptive change, and the end of every good disruption story is, and the incumbent died, right? You know, Blockbuster dead, BlackBerry dead. And it's a really depressing, you know, if you teach it really well, it's depressing. And if you teach it really, really well, some student in the back row is going to say, you know, Professor Smith, can you give me any examples of an industry that's responded well to disruption? And the example I've started to give is the entertainment industry. I think the entertainment industry initially opposed technological change because they rightly saw it as a threat to their way of doing business. And at some point, right around the time that Netflix and Amazon starting to take home all the good awards from all the big award shows, I think the entertainment industry realized that my mission is different than my model. My mission is creating great entertainment and getting that entertainment in front of the audience. And if technology can help me achieve my mission, I'm willing to blow up my model. And I think we've seen that in a lot of settings, right? What's the parallel to higher education? I think if we're going to change, it's going to be because we realize our mission is more important than our model, right? If our mission is helping rich kids get a leg up in the job market, we're doing great, right? But that's not our mission. If our mission is helping kids of all socioeconomic backgrounds understand what their gifts are, develop those gifts so they can use those gifts to the benefit of society, I think technology can help us to achieve that mission in ways that we can't today. And one of the things I'm really hoping I can get from this book is for people in higher education to rediscover our mission.
That is so well said. And as somebody who was a linear television programmer for much of my career, I know what you're talking about, because the power has now reversed and is in the hands of the consumers. They'll watch it where they want, when they want, in the amounts that they want. They don't want to be told that you can only watch this at 8 o'clock at night. And again, if you realize that you're there really to provide them with information and entertainment, then you accept the change that inevitably is wrought by these new technologies. Well, I hope that the university does take upon themselves to learn. They are learners, supposedly.
After all.
they better learn from this, the Abundant University. Michael Smith, I can't thank you enough for your generosity in both your time and your information. It is remarkable, and I'm glad that you are thinking so much about this issue and bringing others along. Thank you.
Larry, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.